this whole idea of ego and who we ought to be and this image and persona that we're trying to create, performing for imaginary people's imaginary expectations of you. I mean, the question I ask my clients all the time is like, when did you decide that?
Welcome to the latest episode of the Live Into Your Brilliance podcast, the place where we shine a light on the innate brilliance of the human condition and have tons of fun blowing up the illusions that get in the way. I am joined, as usual, by my globe-trotting friend who is calling in from another part of the world yet again. Billows, how are you doing? And let the audience in on where you are speaking to us from today.
Hello, my friend. Good to be with you, as always. And today, I am in beautiful Umhlanga Rocks, the gorgeous, fecund KwaZulu-Natal coast in South Africa. I've been working with this amazing company called Magic Orange, which is hopefully going to be a Durban success story and a worldwide phenomenon one day that you'll read about. And literally jumped in an Uber, rushed over here, and happy to join you both. So
awesome. Sounds incredible. Well, today, Billows, we're also joined by a special guest. Again, I had the pleasure of meeting this man just before Christmas back in November in Santa Monica, an event. And we made a very special connection, and I'm excited to have him in conversation with us today. So we are welcoming Hakeem Lakhdar to the show. And Hakeem is first and foremost a husband to his beautiful wife, Caitlin, and a devoted father to their six-year-old identical twin boys, which we've had some fun conversations about the adventures of parenting when you've got two little tyros like that. He has led many lives, and you know, as I read this bio before, I won't lie, I had some jealousy and envy flood through me. When it's pretty spectacular. He has been featured as a musical act at Irish Kevin's in Key West. He has been in acting and stunts, been a stuntman in South Florida, and he has traveled the world for work. He spent his early years in the Middle East, was raised in South Florida in the USA, completing his undergraduate and graduate work at Florida State University, Indiana University, and Northeastern University. He's also lived in Indiana, Las Vegas, Washington, D.C., Boston. He's been in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Czech Republic, and India, just to name some of the destinations that Hakeem has been around the globe. Once into his fully into his career, Hakeem has spent nearly two decades working in the legal profession, developing professional and executive education programs at institutions such as the American Bar Association, Harvard Law School, and the University of Miami School of Law. And throughout his career, he has been responsible for managing and leading teams, both big and small, domestically and internationally. And throughout, he's always been intimately involved in some aspect of coaching, advising, or professional development. Hakeem is now a full-time, highly qualified executive coach. NLP certifications, conversational hypnosis, time techniques, EFT tapping, to name but a few. And, you know, the thing that I love about Hakeem, and one of the reasons I'm so excited to have him on, is, you know, Hakeem is a deeply intuitive coach. And he brings his love of people to every aspect of his coaching. And it's this passion for coaching senior professionals to effectively lead themselves with others and others with clarity, confidence, and compassion that is really compelling. So Hakeem, you've got an incredible story. We are super excited to have you on the show. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me. Even as you were going through the bio, I kept thinking, who's this guy he's talking about? Feels like lifetimes ago that I was doing some of those things, but I feel very fortunate, and thank you so much for the kind introduction.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. Well, look, you know, Hakeem, we always kind of start in the same place, which, you know, as we said in the intro, we have fun shining a light on human brilliance and blowing up the illusions and getting the way. But we really want to do that through your story. And there's no better person to tell your story than yourself. When we were talking in advance of coming online, you'd said to me before that the reason you got into coaching was that you didn't like seeing people unhappy at work. And I'd love to just throw that into the mix and kind of you take start from wherever you want in terms of your story. But I would love to know what you mean by that, what you see as possible for people. And yeah, you kick us off wherever you want and we'll see where we go from there.
Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, I think it all came from a question I got on another interview one time where someone asked me, so why leadership coaching? Why did you get into executive leadership coaching? And beyond the obvious answer that I have done this in my career for the last nearly two decades or more, I was trying to think of something pithy and something sexy that I could say that would be, you know, would blow their minds. And then when I realized that, honestly, it's the very unsophisticated, simple answer of, I just don't like seeing people unhappy at work. And when I came to that conclusion, that's my go-to answer now, because it's simple and it's easy to understand. And we all know people who are struggling at work and how taxing that can be on their lives, both professionally and personally. And when you track it back, it usually tracks back to poor leadership. So when people are really struggling at work, it's usually because there's poor leadership. And we've seen all the memes on LinkedIn and social media, you know, people don't leave bad jobs, they leave bad bosses. But there's truth to that. You know, the fact is, when you are working for someone who struggles as a leader, everybody around them struggles. And then guess what? You struggle in other areas of your life outside of work, as a husband, as a wife, as a mother, as a father, as a son, as a daughter. And I felt like I've been working with leaders my whole career. Why not focus on them in my coaching?
Yeah, this is one of the topics that I'm very excited about getting into, because one of my favorite authors and thinkers on this is a guy called Raj Sisodia, and he's a professor at Babson College, and he's written a number of books. And I was fortunate enough to attend a couple of his talks, and he did a few things when we were at Mimecast and put some ideas in the room, which kind of rocked our world. But, you know, this concept of being unhappy at work or being miserable at work, I think it's a pandemic. And I think more and more, you know, and I don't know what the stats are globally, but I think, you know, historically we are at an all-time low in terms of, you know, 60 to 70% of American adults right now. And this is probably indicative of the global poll as well. It's probably not far off. But 60 to 70% of American adults are miserable in their jobs, would love to change their jobs. Suicides are at an all-time high amongst working professionals. And you know, people feel stuck. And then when the economy goes to shit and mortgage rates rise and a basket of ordinary groceries costs, you know, 30% more, whatever the ridiculous rates are, you feel even more stuck because you can't see your way out of this mire. And it's like this pressure cooker of misery and yeah, it's so unhealthy. And it's not to say that they're just, you know, everybody's in a shit job, but it's that, you know, to your point, like, leaders don't know what the hell they're doing a lot of the time. And they're probably miserable as well. And so that kind of permeates and echoes and ripples through. But it's, you know, but it's this idea that we've been kind of pimping on this podcast for a while, is it's 100% down to you only 100% of the time. And so creating an experience of life where you're not miserable, you're not succumbing to the pressures that are perceived and a lot of the illusions that we love to blow up on the show is it's within grasp, but it like pointing to that is freaking hard. And for people to see it is even harder when they're deep in it. I'd love to get your take on that commentary, because you must have experienced that or seen a version of that as you sort of dived into this world of helping people not be miserable at work.
Yeah. And I agree with all of that, and it can feel really heavy, and it doesn't have to. And it's not to dismiss all of that as untrue or not happening out in the world, because it is. As I mentioned, I'm a husband, I'm a father. We lived in our little apartment in Boston when my wife and I were, just early on in our dating, and all we had to worry about was what cool restaurant we were going to go to next. And now we have family and house and cars and kids and all of these different responsibilities, and we feel the pressure. But I think what I have seen throughout my career, and certainly when I'm having more intimate conversations with my clients, is that, and this is something I talk about in my leadership training, but also I talk about one-on-one, is it all comes down to self-leadership. And you touched on that, Billows. It's only our responsibility 100% of the time. And the fact is, if we can recognize the power that we have to create our circumstances, then we don't feel that stuck all the time. We feel like we have a lot more agency in what we do with our lives. And in the context of our professional lives and leadership, I want leaders to be a resource for people. So while I always joke, half joke, that I can't go around giving every unhappy person at work a hug and tell them it's going to be okay, I can work with leaders who can then be that for their teams and be that for their organizations and be that for their businesses. And I think when leaders see their role as purely, X's and O's, or just sort of cranking through the operations of what a leader ought to be, and they don't see it as a responsibility to care for other people. And I know there's a Simon Sinek quote in there somewhere. I think it's, it's not that we're in charge of others, or it's caring for those who are in our charge. Then all of a sudden, you get to be that resource for people. And the example, leadership by example is never so true, when you can show people that I'm not just going to sit here and wallow in whatever struggles I may be facing or the difficulty that I may encounter, but actually that challenges are opportunities for growth, that I'm resilient, that I can be optimistic, I can be positive. That's not a weakness, it's a strength. All of that then demonstrated to your team creates that awareness and creates that possibility in them to then lead themselves in that way.
Hakeem, there's so much in what you said there. I'm really interested, and I'm maybe riffing off that Simon Sinek quote that you point to and what you're pointing to. Caring for those in your charge. And you and I have talked about this before. Like I would describe you as a deeply loving man. You've got like a big-hearted bear, someone who, you do give great hugs to people and you're always kind of looking after the other person. But you're also a very strong human being. And we talked about like how sometimes that seems so alluring to people. Like they're kind of drawn to the idea of like, can you be full of love and care and emotion for others and still be a strong leader? And often I think people get torn between those two things. And I'd love to know what it is you've seen on your own personal journey in terms of like what's on offer there and how you draw a possibility, point to a possibility for leaders in the like how they can have the best of both of those worlds.
That's a great question. And thank you for your kind comments, Al. I appreciate that. It makes me think of another question I had one time where someone asked, so how long have you been coaching, or how long have you been doing coaching in your career? And I said, honestly, it's not a career pursuit. I've been doing this since I was 7 years old. And for me, it's something that comes quite naturally. I was very much that kid who, when their friend was picked last for kickball or not picked at all, I was the one who said, you know, I'm going to sit this game out. I'd go walk the fence line with them. And we'd talk about why not being picked for kickball didn't define them, and that, you know, we can still have fun even though we're not playing with the, you know, it was just, that was just innate in me. It was something that I felt drawn to do for people. And that persisted throughout my younger years until I got to a place where I was a working professional. And then I started to see people misinterpret that for weakness. And that really bothered me. I mean, I think I struggled with that in my early years. I still remember a boss who told me, stop writing such nice emails. You're giving people the impression that you have too much time on your hands. And I thought to myself, that's taken me 25 seconds more to write, have a good day, or hope your meeting went well yesterday. Are you seriously telling me just to get to the point, be direct? And yes, there's value in that in, you know, various times and places. But you're asking me to compromise on who I know myself to be, and also what I think is going to serve me best as a leader. And I smiled and nodded when he gave me that advice, and I went right back to writing my super nice flowery emails, because I wanted to test that theory. I hadn't been in my career long enough to know if that was actually true, and I was curious to see, like, okay, this whole nice guys finish last thing, let's see if that really plays out. Because this isn't just about being nice or being a doormat or being seen as someone who doesn't have boundaries or can't take a stand for themselves. But really, it's about knowing yourself enough to be comfortable and confident to approach the world, your colleagues, your friends, your family in that vulnerable way, in that loving way, and do it from a place of strength. So I think the answer, it's a long way of answering your question, but I think the answer to your question is almost in your question. You know, the distinction that we make between being loving and warm and compassionate and being a strong leader, how do we do both? And I see them as one and the same thing. So rather than me trying to toggle between strong leader and loving person, I'm just a strong, loving leader. And that's what makes me a strong leader. And I think that if people can start to disassociate, well, in this moment, I'll be caring, but then I'm gonna have to go back to being a strong leader. I mean, the number of clients that I've heard talk about having to put on various hats that they wear as leaders, and I'm sure all leaders can relate to that. One of those hats is like, well, I'm going to be the compassionate leader right now. Why are we just going to be a compassionate leader for 5 minutes? And then who are you returning to after you take that compassion hat off? And I think once we can presence ourselves to actually that approach to leadership is strong leadership and creates results and helps retain talent and creates a psychologically safe environment for people to work and thrive, then I think people are going to start to really gravitate to that being a much more functional approach to how we lead people.
Now, Kim, why do you think, and I don't want to be like, express any kind of major gender bias here, but I'm going to say it anyway. Like, why do you think dudes in particular struggle with this? I mean, I know some women also see that as a weakness, and you know, the sad part is when they do bring their that female energy into the workplace and the emotion and the love, you know, they sometimes feel, and I've witnessed this, they feel that they're being weak when actually it's a very powerful thing. And you know, not to pimp Raj again, but Raj Sisodia talks about Shakti, you know, energy in female energy in the workplace, and he's written a book about that as well. But why do you think dudes struggle with that so much? Like, what is it that we perceive? Because we do have more and more role models, I think, in the world who are willing to be vulnerable, are willing to be authentically themselves and operate from that place of love, who are, I mean, just look at the Super Bowl, you know? I mean, you know, some of the expressions of love and emotion and vulnerability that go on amongst the winners and the losers. And these are, you know, your quintessential alpha males, and they're doing this. And so why do you think people struggle with this so much, and particularly dudes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the question, Billows. I think that is the question. Why do you struggle with this? Because what I think my first impulse to answer that, which may be a little provocative, is I think there's a projection element to it. I think that if someone isn't comfortable being that way, they are going to project a certain discomfort with being that way. And then guess what? The people around you are going to be uncomfortable with you being that way because it doesn't feel authentic, or it doesn't feel like that's coming from a place of confidence or an understanding of that's who you are. You may feel like you can't manage it or that you shouldn't be. So you're in constant conflict with yourself over this feeling, rather than just accepting that's who you are, and it doesn't make you weak or a good person or a bad person, just who you are and how you feel in this moment, and that's okay. I think that's probably why you're singing the Super Bowl, because there's just sort of like, you know, they're pumping full of adrenaline. They're not editing themselves. They're just sort of shouting what they feel, so exciting, and they're so authentic with their emotion that it comes out in the way that it comes out. And I think you're right that, yes, there's more demonstrations of this, but the reasons why, you know, guys struggle with this potentially more than women could be a variety of reasons. Could be, you know, wiring. It could be, I mean, I'm sure people would argue that there's biological pieces to that. I'm sure that it's, for me, I think it's a lot of conditioning. I mean, my father is a deeply emotional, deeply passionate person. He did not show a lot of emotion, did not show a lot of that in my upbringing. So it wasn't like that was modeled to me to be vulnerable and to share openly and to love deeply. I just sensed that in myself. It wasn't squashed out of me, fortunately, in my younger years. And then I learned to embrace it and to accept it. I had many opportunities along the way to draw that back and say, I'm not going to be that guy. I had many failed relationships. You can go back and ask many ex-girlfriends, why did things not work out? And she's like, oh, he's too sensitive. Or, you know, they just weren't used to that. And I'm sure that if we were to go have the conversation about what they might like in their lives now, or would they feel differently at this point in time, they may say that they feel differently because they've had time to reflect on how valuable that can be, not only in a relationship, but in life for themselves, for their partner. And I was fortunate, I think, enough to recognize that early on in life and then put the work in to be okay with that and to really embrace that. And to go from hearing, don't be so sensitive, for many years growing up, to realizing that that sensitivity is actually my superpower. I don't mean to use overuse the word superpower, but really, it truly is. Then it just gave me this sense of peace and acceptance and excitement that I was unique in that way and could utilize that to forge deeper connections and relationships.
Mm. And it's interesting, you know, the one thing that jumps out at me is the power of the work you do with leaders and you know, the work that Al and I do with the leaders and groups is when you encourage these leaders to think or consider the self at the heart of their transformation. So irrespective of how they want to lead, manage, and coach, but when they see that in order to transform the business, they must transform themselves, and they start to use language, which I think for a lot of people, especially men, but for a lot of leaders, women included, it feels very uncomfortable. It feels awkward talking about, you know, loving your colleagues or, you know, loving the customer and starting to use language where, you know, you really start to shift, the, the tone and the what is perceived as sterile to something that comes alive and is rich and colorful and embodies who we authentically are. What the most amazing thing about that is it legitimizes it instantly in the business. And I've seen this firsthand, you know, when you use language, and people will laugh. Sometimes they'll laugh. You know, if I write an email and I say, "Hey, beautiful people," people are like, "Oh, here we go. Bilby's on a rant again." But over time, it legitimizes that language and that approach in the business. And then you start to see it coming back, you know, and people saying, "Hey, love and respect." And you're like, "Yeah, this is like, we're like the Borg, baby. We're getting in there and we're taking over. Like, this is good stuff." Like, it's starting to get into the drinking water and people don't even realize it. And it's such a powerful thing. And I see this particularly when CEOs and their executive teams start to use this language, they start to legitimize things in a way where people, and it's funny, the change can be very quick. People go, "Oh, that's what bold leadership looks like. Damn, okay, maybe I need to get on that bus. Because, you know, if I want to get the promotion or I want to get the whatever, like that's what good, bold leadership looks like." And it's so powerful. You know, and one of my heroes, I think Nelson Mandela, did this so beautifully. Like, the language he used and the love that he showed up with every single time was so powerfully overwhelming and legitimized by his voice, his choice of words, his action. And even the most hardened, capitalistic, you know, snub-nosed Wall Street, you know, bulldog would melt in his presence because he was using language that spoke directly to what all of us possess, and so few of us have the boldness to put front and center.
Yeah, I love that, and I love thinking about the Mandela example, because you know, when you talk about vulnerability, I mean, you're essentially putting the sword in their hand. You know, you're saying like, I'm completely unarmed here. I have no agenda. My hands are free. You can see that I'm coming to you freely with, you know, from a place of love. And I know it sounds fluffy and flowery, but when you think about it in the context of leadership, everyone's just protecting themselves. You know, we hear about this in the work that we do. This is, you know, all of these habits and patterns that we formed over time from our childhood. They're meant to, you know, meant to be there to protect us, yada, yada. We know that story. But people who choose a certain style or philosophy of leadership, they're doing that to protect themselves too. They don't want to be found out. They don't want to be taken advantage of. They don't want to be seen as weak. They don't want, whatever it might be. And the list goes on and on. And when you can come and just say, I just want to be here to do the best work I can and to care for all of you so you guys can do the best work that you can do. How refreshing. You don't have to worry about what version of leader you're getting or how you have to show up or how to edit yourself so that they're not going to exploit what you said or what you didn't say or did or didn't do. This person's just here to help you.
I want to take you back to the 7-year-old Hakim for a second, just in the context of what you're talking about. Because I have this picture, this lovely young boy who's just open-hearted. And I think of your 6-year-old twins. I think about my boys, Finley and Dylan, Billows' girls. And there's something that you said, you know, that when you said before about, well, I wasn't going to compromise on who I know to be. And it strikes me that kids, like they don't have to be taught this stuff because they know this stuff. They're actually taught the other stuff. And So I'm really curious as to what are the illusions, or what is the illusion that you think has got to be blown up, that is the thing that is getting in the way of what is in our nature? Like, it's not something that we're inviting people to say, hey, you've got to really learn this. It's this, to my mind, exists in everybody, but there's some shitty things that are getting in the way that we need to blow up. And I'm really curious as to what you see those to be and how you point at them in a way that they dissipate or dissolve for leaders that you work with or that you'd be offering up to the person listening to this that might just be the nudge that kicks the sand and the sandcastle falls away.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a good question, Al. I say this not to be discouraging, but I think that my quick answer to that, and then I'll expand upon it, is that I don't think that you can blow them up. And I don't think that they can dissipate. I think they'll always be there because we're a person in the world. We have relationships and experiences and, you know, challenges that we overcome and face. And I think that those will always persist. It's our relationship to them. So I was doing a training for a company out of the UK recently, and I was telling them that, you know, as babies, when we come into this world, we come in with two fears: falling and loud noises. That's it. Those are our two fears. Everything else, rejection, right? Rejection, underperforming, not being fit enough, not being strong enough, all of the not enough that we come up with, that's all learned. That's all adopted over time based on our experiences, what we're exposed to. And to think that we can go around just pew, 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 just trying to shoot them down as they pop up would be, I think, absolutely exhausting. So while it might feel discouraging at first, I actually think that it should be somewhat of a relief to know you don't have to go around trying to, you know, dynamite every single thing that could come up that causes you to question. It's okay. It's okay to question. It's okay to face that. It's okay to feel that. But then you got to return back to what you know to be true. And that's the practice that I don't know if I had been guided through that or that had been modeled to me in some way. But early on in my life, I realized it took a lot more energy for me to manufacture a version of myself than it did for me just to be myself. And I think of it, you know, you may have heard me talk about this, Al, as the definition that I read one time about being in an ego hell. And the idea behind that is performing for imaginary people's imaginary expectations of you. And this whole idea of ego and who we ought to be in this image and persona that we're trying to create, performing for imaginary people's imaginary expectations of you. I mean, the question I ask my clients all the time is like, when did you decide that? When did you decide that that's how you had to be? When did you decide that's how the world was? And when did you decide that that's how your team was going to perform? There's a decision, there's a choice there. There's a moment in time where we decided this is now going to be, I'm going to incorporate that into how I see the world, how I see myself in the world. And if it doesn't serve you, then you're going to let that fall away. Acknowledge it, recognize it, sure, but don't adopt it. Don't put it into your travel bag and then take it with you. Leave that back there where you found it. And I think that for me is one of the biggest things that has served me.
Like I love that answer because it does. I think you've done something there, which is kind of, you've done a both and for me. So you've blown up the illusion. There's like a double illusion that's kind of been, maybe, you know, it's like lifting up so you kind of see the magic going on behind the illusion. Because one, there's the illusions, which are like imaginary people's imaginary expectations. And it's just noticing that when we're living in the idea in our mind that we know someone else's expectations of us, that's just an illusion. It's a mirage that we are choosing to buy into. And we're going to do that, which is what I hear you saying. It's like, that's going to happen. But when you know it's an illusion, it's like going to a magic show and still being able to enjoy the magic and know that it's real. It's like, oh, I can be with the illusion and it doesn't have any power over me because I know it's an illusion. And that to me is the difference between when we're holding something to be solid, like the table. No. You know, arguing for, nope, they really are the expectations that I have to live up to. It's like, no, that's not true. But the double whammy that I hear in what you say is there's another illusion, which is that there's a life to be lived somewhere where we don't experience these illusions. And that's not available either. And but people who live and lead like you do, and like the leaders like Billows is talking about, and it's not that they don't have the same illusions, it's that they don't buy into them to the same degree. They are able to be with them and recognize them and then come back to themselves. And so, you know, I guess I'd love to make another invitation off the back of that, because I'm always really interested in the statement of, you know, just be yourself. And you said something there, and I can't quite remember exactly how you said it, but it was something along the lines of that you recognized it was easier to be yourself than to try and live up to an idea that you would create of yourself. But I think that's something for people, this idea of being yourself. And I'm always curious how people define that for others, or because it's sometimes thrown around in a way, I'm not saying you've done this, but it's thrown around in a way that can actually throw people off balance, because they're like, I'm not quite sure what that means, because I've become so practiced as showing up into my persona. Then it's like, well, what is the key, would you say, to being yourself? Like, where does that live for you? How do you help people tap back into that intuitive, innate way of being yourself in the moment?
I think you're right, Al. I think you're right that people do throw that around because it's easy. It's, you know, it's an easy way to sort of brush over, oh, just be yourself. I think the way I think about it is in terms of like incongruencies or misalignment, and it's a big feeling thing. I mean, I think you have to let yourself feel where there's an incongruency, where there's a misalignment. And it might be super subtle, but that super subtle misalignment or incongruency into how you naturally want to respond or react or behave or communicate or feel over time becomes a habit, becomes a pattern, and becomes exhausting. So that's why, going back to all full circle to what Bills was talking about, people feeling miserable, they're miserable because they're exhausted. They're unhappy because they're fatigued by creating. I mean, think about it as like if Halloween was every day, I would hate the holiday. I don't want to put a costume on, take it off, put it on, take it off, put it on, take it off every single day. Halloween's fun because it's one time a year. You know, and I remember having a conversation with my wife one time, and she was really struggling, and boys were younger, and she just was so tired. And she said to me at one point, she's like, you know, it's just so hard. I've got like all these different hats, like mom and wife and daughter and brother and sister-in-law and daughter. I mean, all these different hats. And I said, what if I just got you a hat that said Caitlin on it? And you just wore that one hat. And you just never took it off. And there was like this moment where her eyes just teared up. And it wasn't, I mean, I wasn't saying it to create this emotional reaction in her, but I was just thinking, how can I simplify this in a way that we're, you know, talking about it in this metaphor? And when she thought about that, just the act of on, off, on, off, on, off all day, the thought of putting on the hat that is me and just sort of feeling into that all day and operating from that place, that felt so much more refreshing, so much more free. And I think that when I'm working with my clients on this, I'm asking questions to them about, well, how does that feel? Why did you choose to take that approach? Now, if they tell me in this exuberant, confident, excitable, very authentic way why they chose to take that approach, clearly it came from a place of, you know, deep desire, some place within. But I talked a lot about this outside in thinking versus this inside out thinking. Are you looking at the world outside of you and then allowing that to shape who you are inside and the questions and the answers and everything that you come up with internally for yourself? Or are you starting here and then letting what you know to be true in here shape the world outside of you? And a lot of people don't like that question because, to your point, they haven't taken the time to reflect. And it does take time and it does take work and it is uncomfortable. But if in a safe place with a person you trust or know, or, you know, who's willing to do that work, and it doesn't have to be a coach, it can be someone that's close to you in your life, you can have those conversations, you can reflect in that way. And even in your own time with yourself, you'll start to notice those incongruencies, you'll start to notice that misalignment. And then you get to make the choice. Do I want to keep acting and behaving in this way that's incongruent, or do I want to just sort of settle back into this really nice spot that I fit perfectly in? That's me. That's my true self. That's me just being myself. And that feels good.
I think that's a really interesting thing you're pointing to there, because I've said it before a number of times on this podcast that it is absolutely freaking exhausting, you know, living up to the illusions and operating from that place. But the interesting thing is, and I'd love your perspective on this, because I'm sure there's a listener who this is resonating with, and they can't get out of the spiral. You know, they're like, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, how do I separate from my illusions, and how do I go about kind of being myself and showing up authentically? And I'd love your take on the idea that sometimes we actually have to hit rock bottom in order to realize how exhausted we've become, and that the answer we've been looking for has been there all along. And I'm curious, in the work that you do with leaders, do you see leaders sometimes coming to you because they've hit rock bottom?
I have. I absolutely have seen leaders hit rock bottom. But I think that on their way to hitting rock bottom, they get a taste of what that realness feels like. And then it's almost like they're falling down this hole and there's a rope, you know, dangling next to you as you're falling. And then all of a sudden you realize, like, you can feel it rubbing on your arm, and you reach out and you grab it at the last moment. And you realize, oh, I'm holding onto a rope that now, if I start to climb, it's not easy, but if I start to climb, I can actually climb my way out of this, because I realize now the comfort, the clarity that I'm starting to get as I start to fall. And again, fall, when we say rock bottom, I think people can think, you know, like, think about that in dramatic terms. But I think rock bottom's in, like, am I doing the right thing in my career, or my team's really not performing well? I mean, it could be, you know, somewhat insignificant, but it can be these questions that we just ask ourselves in the day. And when you've asked yourself, why am I still even in this job for the last 10 years? That could be rock bottom, even though it's not rock bottom. It could be a moment where you realize, I don't have any more energy to even ask myself this question anymore. Answer the question. I mean, and I think that's when I'm in conversation with people, and they'll say, you know, well, I just don't know why I'm in this job anymore. And I was like, well, have you answered that question? Sometimes people get stuck in this pattern of just asking these questions because that just feels like they're addressing it, or that they're looking at it, but they're not actually answering the question. And I've I've worked on this in my own coaching. I'm always asking questions. Sometimes I don't answer them. And guess what? I wake up tomorrow and I'm asking the same question again until I actually stop, journal, reflect, and answer the question. And in answering it, I usually get my answer, which is either aligned with what I'm doing or not aligned. And then again, it comes back to me having the choice whether or not I want to continue doing something that's inauthentic or misaligned, or if I want to change directions and do something else.
Well, it's like that story, isn't it? There's a story of the man facing a firing squad, and the guns are pointed at him, and the captain comes over and says, "Hey, we'll give you a choice. You can leave through that door and face unknown terrors, or you can stay here in front of the firing squad." And the man says, "That's fine, I'll stay where I am, thanks." And that's what we do. Like, the choice sometimes between being ourselves, it's like, well, it's sometimes easier to stay in suffering. It seems, the illusion is that it's easier to stay in suffering rather than face the unknown. And so when we think about being ourselves, the courage to be ourselves is that we don't know what's on the other side of that in terms of like what's going to happen and, you know, how are people going to react, and not everyone's going to be a cheerleader, you know, for you making your choices. You know, when you told your story about your old boss saying, "Hey, you know, you need to sharpen those emails up and get, you know, be more to the point, like stop being so nice." And you're like, well, I'm not going to do that. Now, I don't know what his or her reaction to that was, but sometimes that's the choice we have to make. But it's knowing that, like, actually that's the greatest opportunity, I think, is the courage to be ourselves is rewarding beyond measure, but not in the way that we make it up to be. It's not like, well, so if I choose to be myself, will that mean that every single person's going to high-five me and that I'm going to get everything I want? It's like, no, it doesn't mean that. But what it means is that you will be able to live a life of peace, more joy, because as you say, there's that absence of you're congruent versus incongruent. You're able to go, no, well, I'm being true to myself. And I think that, I'm curious what you take, that to me seems like one of the biggest opportunities, but yet one of the toughest, because society today is built to reward conformity. And yet, I'm curious if this is like when you kind of started to touch on it, is the happiness that people want at work? I wonder if there's part of that which is you can have happiness anywhere you are, whether it's work or whatever, because if we're talking about happiness in this context, it's the feeling of being true to yourself is the ultimate reward in many ways. Like that's what's coming to mind for me, and I'm curious if that's how you would see it, or if where you might point to from there.
Yeah. You know, it makes me think of the first time that I ever heard a client say this, and I've now heard it many more times than I ever thought I would, that when we're talking about ways in which a particular person that I'm working with wants to shift their style of leadership, whether it's leading others or leading themselves, the number of times that this comment comes up is always so surprising to me that I'm not sure how other people are going to react to me changing in this way. And we'll spend another 15, 20, 30 minutes on just on that alone, because that is so meaty. Because what are you talking about? I'm not talking about all those other people. I'm talking about you. What do you want to do? Well, I don't know how they're going to receive me. They don't know me like that. Okay, well, they don't know you like that because this is who you've shown them. This is who you've given them. We get to have a conversation about, well, where does that come from? Where did you go down the grocery store aisle and decide you're going to pick out this version of yourself and that's going to be the version of you forever because that people like the way that tastes or that sits well with people? Is that aligned with who you are? Because if it is, great. That works out pretty well for you. If it's not, it's going to be a long, long struggle of an existence.
Yeah, I was laughing away as you said that. I had a brilliant coach, lady by the name of Andrea First, and I once said to her, I said, I just want people to be a bit more considerate of my feelings. And she just went, why would they be? You never show them your feelings. And I was like, oh, shit. And she was like, yeah, Alan, if you don't show people your feelings, why would they ever be considerate of them? Like, that's not how you show up. And so it's this, we get exactly reflected back to us.
Yeah.
Who we be in any moment. And just as you were saying that, it flooded back into my mind. And I remember it being a real slap in the face. I was like, oh, shit, you mean it's me again? She was like, yep. Only 100% of the time, big guy. And you're like, damn.
And we hear that same sort of analogy around boundaries, you know, that expression, if you don't set boundaries, people will set them for you, that kind of thing. Well, the same is true about how you want to be received in the world. And that was my response earlier about that sort of projection piece when Bills was asking me why some people struggle with being loving or, you know, vulnerable or compassionate, why that's easier for some versus the other. I think the people who struggle with it are the people who are intent on projecting a certain image so that when they do let themselves, if and when they do let themselves be vulnerable, it feels so unnatural for them that the people around them don't react to it in the way that they're hoping that they'll react to it. So that just solidifies their desire to never do that again. Well, I'm not going to do that again. That didn't feel good. That didn't yield the result I wanted. And it's not about that. It's about that alignment, that congruency. And if you can create that in yourself, when you're feeling that, the people around you are going to feel that and they're going to respond to that kind of in kind.
I did an interesting thing this morning. I've never done it, but you know, I love to start when I do group facilitation, love to start with an icebreaker. And the whole point of the icebreaker is obviously just to get people relaxed and get a laugh in the room and get the energy up. Cause you know, people arrive at these things and some of them have never met some of them and some of them have never met the senior people and, you know, it'll get all in their heads and, you know, and so, so I took everybody outside this morning and there were 31 people and we broke into these four groups and I made them reach across, stand in a circle, group of eight, three groups of eight and a group of seven, reach across the circle, grab hands in a haphazard way. And then it was like the human knot thing. And then you're like, okay, now untangle yourselves. And it is so wonderful to see how people, A, realize they're fucked because they're in this knot, right? So they're like, oh my God, what has he done to us? And then I'm like, you can't let go of hands. And now you got to figure this out. And they're like, and they instantly go to that childlike state. They burst out laughing. They giggling. They start smiling. And then from that place, they get super creative and they start to figure out that you can step over arms and you can lower your bonded arms and somebody can step over and somebody can pirouette around the top. And eventually they untangle themselves and they're standing in this circle again, some of them facing backwards. That's okay. But it's like this wonderful way of just seeing what happens when people get out of their heads and they get out of the illusion of what being at a corporate event strategy workshop is meant to be. And they revert, they are invited to tap into that love and that playfulness and be present. And then from there, see what the art of the possible is. See that a seemingly impossible task suddenly becomes possible. And then carrying that energy into having the juicy discussions about how to grow this phenomenal thing. And it's like, it was such an interesting exercise And I'm going to use it more and more because it instantly takes people to that place and it gets them to tap into the essence of who they are without them realizing it. And then you point it out at the end. You say, hey, seems like you guys were having a lot of fun, a lot of love and presence being exhibited right now. And they're like, oh, damn, yeah, you're right. I wasn't in my head. You know, I wasn't prejudging somebody, or I wasn't kind of like lining up my Scud missile for why I think our strategy sucks. It was just like everything just melted away. And it's funny, and you know, we talk about practice a lot on this show. And you know, the person listening, I think, often wants to know, well, how do I get there? And I think, you know, we had an amazing guest, Rob. When Rob said, close your eyes and think about what it must be like to be a baby coming into the world, and just that infinite possibility. That kind of like that warm, fuzzy feeling of just like anything's possible. That's what came through for me. And I think giving people just a simple way of going back to that place and constantly tapping into that. The moment the noise in your head, the judgment, the lack of curiosity, the lack of empathy and love exists, giving them something where they can just go back and reconnect with that. And the more, you know, to your point about it is hard work to climb out up that rope, but it gets easier and easier, and your strength returns like exponentially when you can tap into that place. And I'd love, like, are there things that you do with your clients where you're like, hey, if you find yourself in your head, and you find yourself drifting away from that natural state, like this is what you should do to pull yourself back. Do you have some kind of like practical thing like that that you could give our listener?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is something that I use when I'm working with clients as part of the Training Rock, which is a company out of the UK that I work with. And we talk a lot about inner critic, and we talk about how, as I was mentioning earlier, in our younger years, you know, we have this inner voice. It's a lot less critical. But as we get older and we start to acquire some experiences and we develop habits and patterns, that inner voice becomes an inner critic. And it judges us. It compares us. It starts to shape who we think we ought to be based on imaginary people's expectations, all those ideas. It's ego-based, all of that. So the easy way to do it, and I ask my clients this, in our sessions, but then also encourage them to do this for themselves if and when they find themselves struggling with, you know, this loud inner critic, is just to simply ask three questions. Is it true? What's the evidence? Do I know that for a fact? And if you can present yourself with, is it true? What's the evidence? And do I know that evidence to be a fact? You realize that a lot of it is just, it's just an illusion. It's just conjecture. It's just an assumption. It's just something that you saw in a movie last night. It's filtered into your brain, or something that was modeled to you early on. And I think that that's something that can be really useful if you're really honest about it. And it can be used in reverse. When someone reaffirms something that you know to be true about you, you can say, is that actually true? Yeah, it is. I am that kind of person. I am that person. What's the evidence? Yeah, I am deeply loving. Do I know it for a fact? Yeah, I see that evidence everywhere in my life. I know that to be true. And then sort of anchor into that.
No, thank you. Thank you. I think that's super, super generous and super helpful, because I think the listener loves hearing how to put all of this into practice in a very tangible way. So thanks, Hakim. That was awesome.
My pleasure. Absolutely. I think it's easy for us to overcomplicate it.
I think you're hitting the nail on the head, which is, I just love how simple those three questions are. Simple, powerful, pattern interrupts, and the way that you flip them, one or the other, like, what is it true? And what's the evidence? And when you come back to feeling, you know, we talk about the closed fist and the open hand. To my mind, like, when we feel ourselves getting uptight, these are such powerful questions, because this might be our inner voice about ourselves. It might be the inner voice about other people. It can be any of those. And it's like, you know, like thinking back to your example before about expectations, like, is it true? Do I have evidence? No, actually. And it's like decoupling the carriages of the train, the thought train. The carriages get decoupled, and suddenly you start slowing down, and the engine's off, gone off. It goes over the edge of the cliff, but you're just there, and you get back to that calm place. So no, I echo Bill's gratitude for that. It's brilliant.
I think one distinction I just wanted to make was with the question of what's the evidence versus is there evidence, is nuanced, but it's important. Because it's easy for us to answer that question yes or no versus what's the evidence. Because our mind is always going to provide evidence. So do I know this to be true? This is true. You know, I'm just not a good singer. Well, what's the evidence? Well, last night's show, there was only five people. No one wanted to listen to me sing. Well, do I know that for a fact? Well, I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I could assume that they didn't want to listen to me sing. So these are, when you ask what's the evidence, it's going back to the not trying to dismiss or blow up or extinguish that any evidence exists. There might be evidence that exists. Present yourself to what the evidence is. So what's the evidence? Well, the evidence is, this or that. Acknowledge it and then ask that follow-up question, but do you know that for a fact? Then you're like, no, that's my inner critic trying to feed me evidence that's false. Good. All right, we can move on. And you just leave it behind you.
Nice. Hakeem, we have a closing tradition on the pod, which is to invite our guests to create their bumper sticker for life. So you are now the master of bumper sticker creations. What would be the Hakeem Lakhdar bumper sticker for life?
I will go with one that we use in our training often, and I have held true to in my own life, which is one of my first three C's. Clarity is kind. It's kind to yourself. It's kind to others. I think when I talk to leaders and they talk about, well, I've got to be more assertive, I've got to be more direct, I said, just be more clear. Being clear upon feedback, about expectations, about whatever it might be, is kind, because you're not creating places where people are going to make assumptions or their inner critic's going to fill the empty space. You're being clear. You're being upfront. I think clarity is kind.
I love that one, because I think clarity also has an essence of giving.
Yes.
And, when you're creating clarity, you're not thinking about yourself. You're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it to empower. And you may think that, it's like selfishly you want everybody to have clarity so that you can look like the hero or achieve whatever. But what you don't realize is what you're actually doing is you're giving somebody this incredibly powerful gift, which is empowering to them. And by the very nature of that giving, you're in service and you're not thinking about yourself, even though you think you might be doing it for yourself.
I love thinking about it that way.
Yeah, that is a very, very powerful. I love that bumper sticker.
Yeah. I'll be getting it printed soon.
Hakeem, for the person listening to this and thinking, "Whoa, I need more of this man in my life," where can they find you and, engage with you and so on?
If you want to reach out, I'm always open to any conversations about this and anything else under the sun. You can find me on LinkedIn easily. You can also find me on my website, lockdarcoaching.com, or shoot me an email at Hakeem@lockdarcoaching.com. I love these conversations. I appreciate both of you for your willingness to have them, and looking forward to connecting with anybody who is excited about talking about these same things.
Awesome. Well, mate, it's been a real pleasure and treasure having you on here today. Like, there's so many nuggets to draw on. Like, the one that really strikes me is this idea of not compromising on who we know to be. It just really resonated with me, but so much in those three questions at the end. Appreciate you, like, as being an incredible role model, I think, for people that really want to know what strong, loving leadership looks like. You know, I think they've got a glimpse of it through this conversation, and I know that the people who work with you really appreciate you for it. And so, you know, heartfelt gratitude from my side for you coming and spending time with us this evening.
Thank you, Al.
Billows, any final words from your side?
Yeah, Hakeem, awesome to meet you online, and can't wait to give you a giant bear hug when we do connect in Maine. That'd be awesome.
You got it, brother.
With some of your wife's family's fine ice cream. Yeah, just thank you for putting what you did into the room and into the airwaves. I know the listener will get a lot of clarity from it, which is an awesome way to spread the kindness. So, and you know, Al and I always say, if we can touch just one person and make them feel something different and see something different, and then live from that place of a peaceful mind and an open heart, then it's job done. And I think you nailed it today, and I know you've cracked open a lot of hearts and created a lot of kindness in the world. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that, brother. I appreciate that. I appreciate both of you having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk about something near and dear to my heart, in many ways. And hopefully conversations like this become more commonplace, and especially, you know, in leadership circles.
Amen to that. I think we're, touch wood, we're part of a growing movement, I think. But again, thank you for listening. Again, I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. And until we speak again, courageously be yourselves and continue to live into your brilliance. Until next time, cheerio.
Thank you for joining us on this enlightening journey, unraveling the innate brilliance within every human being. We hope today's episode has sparked new thoughts and inspired fresh perspectives. Remember, the power to shatter illusions and unleash your true potential lies within you. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite platform. If you'd like more insights and daily doses of inspiration, you can follow me on Instagram at @AlKennyCoaching. Or you can connect with myself and Mark on LinkedIn, where we will share articles and perspectives about unlocking your innate brilliance. Remember, you are capable of extraordinary things. Keep believing, keep exploring, and keep shining brightly. Take care and stay brilliant.